Welcome back to New Books in Religion. Thanks again for joining us. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For this program, I had the pleasure of speaking with Andrea Jane about her great new book, Selling Yoga, From Counterculture to Pop Culture, published with Oxford University Press in 2014. Is yoga religious? This question has not only been asked recently in the broader public, but also posed in the courts. Many argue that of course it is. The story of yoga in popular imagination is often narrated as an ancient wisdom tradition that informs contemporary postural movements which are intricately connected and indivisible. Others contend that contemporary yoga is simply a set of health practices that have nothing to do with religion. In this great new book, Andrea Jane helps us navigate the recent history of yoga in the West and the debates surrounding its religious nature. Overall, what we find is that while yoga has been mediated through an emerging global consumer market and branded for strategic purposes, it can still be seen to serve the function of a body of religious practice for many practitioners. In our conversation, we discussed Hindu, Buddhist, Jain variations of yogic practices, Idocratics, Church of Yoga, legal definitions, Iyengar, Siddha, and Anusara yogas, Theosophists and Transcendentalists, Swami Vivekananda's Vedanta Society, counterculture yogis, consumer culture in the mass market, Christian yoga phobia, the Hindu American Foundation, and the politics of yoga. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Joining me today is Andrea Jane, and we're talking about her great new book, Selling Yoga, From Counterculture to Pop Culture. How's it going, Andrea? How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing really well. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. This is a really fascinating book, bringing together religious studies, economics, kind of postmodern culture, all sorts of interesting stuff. So I'm excited to get into it. But as per tradition, we usually start with a little bit about you and how you got interested in the study of religion, if there was perhaps mentors that you had that were particularly influential in either the content that you're studying or the approach that you take. How'd you get interested in all this?
Sure. Well, I became interested in the study of religion from a really young age. My research now focuses on yoga in contemporary culture, especially its global popularization. That wasn't always my interest, but like popularized yoga, I'm the product of cultural heterogeneity and the consequent encounters between previously isolated cultures in the late 20th century and early 21st century. I'm the daughter of a white mother who grew up in a small blue-collar Protestant community in Illinois, and an Indian father from Mumbai who was raised in an elite Jain Digambara family and immigrated to the United States in the early 1970s. So needless to say, religious and cultural heterogeneity have been lived realities for me for as long as I can remember. And I first became interested in the ways religions were contingent on particular social contexts. When living in Dallas, Texas, I was admitted to an elite conservative Christian evangelical grade school. And there I was driven to rigorous study of the Bible. I was personally motivated. We all had to engage in such rigorous study, but I was personally motivated for the sake of debating my very conservative teachers on the social contingencies of the biblical books. And of course, I couldn't have articulated it like that back then. But I knew that I was opposed to what my teachers thought were the correct and literal interpretations of the Bible. And I thought of their interpretations as having dangerous and oppressive consequences, especially for gender and religious minorities. That's when I became really interested on the social contingencies of religions. Then when I first stepped onto a college campus, my first day of my freshman year, I knew I could never leave academia because I'd never felt so at home anywhere. So I started studying psychology and philosophy were my majors. I didn't know about the field of religious studies. I thought if I wanted to study the history of religions and the social dimensions of religion, I would have to do that in these other areas. It wasn't until later that I took a course for my philosophy major, philosophy of religion, that was actually taught by a religious studies professor. And it was that through that route that I became familiar with the field of religious studies and realized that's where I really belonged. I studied with Bill Barnard, who is still at the college where I was as an undergraduate, which is SMU, Southern Methodist University. And it was taking his courses on Indian religions that got me particularly interested in Hindu and Buddhist and Jain traditions. So I went to graduate school at Rice University. I chose to go there because I wanted to study with Jeffrey Kripal. I was interested in psychoanalysis and religion, and again, Indian religions. And so I started my graduate career there, working toward a doctoral degree in religious studies. And luckily, I was able to go on a research trip to India. And this was in 2006. And I had the opportunity to travel to Rajasthan to research Jain traditions during a summer semester. And I came upon the Jain Shwetambara Therapant, a Jain sectarian tradition. And its guru at the time, Mahapragna, who was famous for having introduced a new form of Jain yoga called Praksha Dhyana. I found myself completely unable to grasp and fully understand the contrast between the world, society, and body-negating ascetic ideology of traditional monastic Jain thought and Mahapragna's active advocacy for modern conceptions of peace, physical health, psychological well-being, and even physical fitness. And so this led to many years of research, which eventually culminated in a dissertation, which really was an ethnographic study of the Jain Therapant as a case study of modern yoga. But it really focused on the Therapant and its particular school of modern yoga, Praksha Dhyana. I eventually then, following the completion of my dissertation, started writing Selling Yoga, in which Praksha Dhyana served as one case study among many of modern yoga in the late 20th century.
Can you talk a little bit about how this project emerged as a book? When did you start to think of this as something that deserves a book-length analysis?
Yeah, sure. I suppose that I always planned on writing a book about the modern popularization of yoga as soon as I discovered Praksha Dhyana. I became really interested in how, nearly immediately upon discovering Praksha Dhyana, I was interested in how it reflected a larger transnational pattern. I basically was certain that I was witnessing an attempt on the part of this particular Jain sect to establish continuity with a global yoga industry in which popularized varieties of postural yoga reflect the dominant consumer demands and desires. So I wanted to focus in the dissertation on this particular case study, but I planned to eventually produce a book that would provide a larger theory of the popularization of yoga. And in order to further explore the global yoga industry and how popularized varieties of yoga have come to intersect with dominant consumer demands and desires.
Now, you explicitly state you're writing both for kind of an academic audience who might be interested in this either in South Asian religions or religious studies, but also to a popular audience, people who do yoga. Did that forethought on your audience, did that affect how you approached writing differently? Or
Yeah. Sorry to cut you off there, but Yeah, absolutely. It was a challenge, really, to speak to multiple audiences. I wanted to speak to a wider audience that would include the wide varieties of those who actually do yoga. And so I deliberately wrote Selling Yoga in a more accessible style and speaking to a wider set of questions and concerns than are usually appealed to in academia. But, you know, being able to do that coming right out of graduate school where I was rigorously trained to speak academies to other academics, it was a real challenge, and it took several drafts and several more years of work. Ultimately, I finished my PhD in 2010, and the book was published in December of 2014. So it took a few years for me to write the additional material that I wanted to include in the book, but also to learn how to write to that wider audience. And it was thanks to my editor at Oxford, Cynthia Reed. I really owe her a debt of gratitude because she was very patient with me and, gave me a lot of feedback and a lot of advice on how I could tweak my language, what I should cut, and how I should adjust my vocabulary and everything to speaking to a larger audience.
Well, I think you were very successful. It's very, very readable, very engaging, and really captures your attention throughout. So congratulations.
Thank you. Well, it took a lot of work. It didn't come easily to me.
One theme that runs through the book, which you address in various places, so I kind of wanted to bring it up now because I think anyone studying religion will be interested in this, but ideas about essentialist characteristics, about borrowing, about exclusivity, about cultural negotiations. You're talking about various traditions, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain. You're talking about East and West in scare quotes. You're talking about religious versus secular society. This, for me, I think comes up all over in the study of religion. So how would you recommend we approach these kind of contested categories that are defined differently across traditions? Do you have any advice for thinking about the way we talk about these things that move and are shaped variously in different contexts?
Yeah, well, I think that we should, first of all, recognize that yoga is just a case study of a much larger human phenomenon. That is that we tend to produce these religious products, and those religious products are perpetually context sensitive. They're perpetually in flux. And so yoga is just one example of really a point that I'm striving to make about religion generally. I talked about how when I first got interested in religion, it was when I was actually a kid and I was actually studying the Bible then. And what interested me about religion then is what interests me today about the study of yoga. And that is the way that yoga is perpetually in flux, that there is actually, from a historical perspective, no legitimate, authentic, orthodox, or original tradition, as both many yoga insiders and many yoga outsiders want to claim. And so really my motivation in writing this book and a motivation underlying my career at large is to convince people to let go of the static categories that we often resort to in talking about religion, and instead recognize that these are all socially contingent and always changing, and there's no legitimate historical project when it comes to identifying an authentic or original tradition, whether it be Christianity or whether it be yoga or whether it be Hinduism or Islam, right? There is no Christianity. There's only Christian traditions. There's no Islam. There's only Islamic traditions. Of course, that's highly offensive to, again, many of the insiders to these traditions who want to claim that there is a static, unchanging essence and a static orthodoxy, a right way or a right path, right? Mm-hmm. But I just don't think that, you know, if we're really honestly committed to the historical critical method, we could assume any of those claims to be true.
Mm. Yeah, and that comes up throughout the book in the sense that you're often dealing with yoga in kind of a popular imagination. So for those who might not be familiar with kind of how narratives about yoga go, could you tell us, if we were to assert that there is a monolithic yoga tradition, how might one tell this story? Where would one begin?
Do you mean in the popular imagination, how it's usually conceived?
Yeah. What's the kind of common narrative about yoga and its origins that you're often trying to analyze and understand in the book?
Sure. Yeah. So there are a couple different narratives that tend to, you know, be dominant in the popular imagination. There's some variations, but the main patterns tend to be that yoga is popularly imagined as having ancient origins in India. Many imagine those origins as being Hindu and especially tied to particular Hindu traditions. For example, the textual tradition of the Yoga Sutras. And sometimes going farther back, the Yoga Sutras can be dated to about the 4th century CE. But yoga is oftentimes imagined as going even farther back than that, that which is conceived of as the original codification of yoga, the Yoga Sutras. Going farther back to the Hindu Veda from, you know, about 1500 BCE, or even farther to the Indus Valley civilization of about 2500 BCE. And so when I say ancient origins, I mean really ancient origins. The Yoga Sutra is often cited as the original codification of yoga, the first time yoga was really systematized in a text. That's also traditionally thought of as a Hindu text, and that's why yoga is oftentimes imagined as being originally Hindu.
Now, as we move into the more modern period, we see yoga being defined, engaged in what you kind of say is counterculture movements. Can you talk a little bit about how Western practitioners are engaging with yoga in the late 19th and early 20th century? How is it being viewed at this time?
Yeah, sure. So yoga, of course, did not take one Hindu form. It took many forms for as far back as historians can study yoga. We've found that yoga has been multifarious. It's taken a variety of Buddhist, Jain, Hindu forms, and then later Islamic forms and others. By the modern period, yoga was popularly imagined by colonialists as something that was very far from what was provided in the Yoga Sutras. Yoga was more often associated with the practices of Hatha yogis, those practicing Hatha yoga, who were engaged in rigorous ascetic practices. And yoga was a very metaphysical practice. It was about manipulating subtle energies within the body and was believed to result in all sorts of supernatural powers. And so, as David Gordon White has said, yogis were thought of as, even by Indians, not just the colonialists, but yogis were popularly imagined as the boogeymen, those who could read your thoughts or sneak into your house at night without being seen. They had all sorts of supernatural powers that were associated with them. Mark Singleton wrote a book that my work builds on the late 19th century and early 20th century construction of modern yoga that sought to basically disassociate yoga from colonialist stereotypes and these popular Indian stereotypes, and instead associate it with a very rational ideological tradition, and one that was rooted in meditation and eventually physical fitness. So that was a very long process that involved many campaigns, including and one of the most significant, just given its given how well known it is the campaign by Swami Vivekananda, who traveled to the United States in the late 20th century. The late 19th century. And he sought to disseminate his vision of yoga, which he linked to the Yoga Sutras. He emphasized the meditative and philosophical dimensions. And he was very successful in reaching a large American and Western European audience with this new vision of yoga that he claimed was very scientific. Nonetheless, it was still countercultural. Yoga was still something that was in India primarily associated with the Hatha yogis, and beyond India was still thought of as counter to Christian orthodoxy and dangerous, especially because it attracted women and was thought of as something that would, you know, steal women away from their marital commitments. And so there were also far more radical or early modern yogis who have largely been ignored in the history books of modern yoga. And I've attempted in Selling Yoga to illuminate some of those figures and really do so in a way that situates them in the history of modern yoga. For example, Ida Craddock was an American, turn of the century American yoga radical. And Pierre Bernard was her contemporary. Both of them attempted to co-opt yoga in a way that married it to theistic conceptions about God that they drew from Christian traditions, as well as modern conceptions of health and fitness. They were far less successful than Vivekananda. They were oftentimes quieted and even imprisoned. Both of them were imprisoned at different times. Ida Craddock ended up killing herself for fear of greater imprisonment because she was certain to go to prison. She was certain she would return to prison for what people claimed was the obscenity of her texts on yoga and sex. So it wasn't until much later that yoga became something that was popularly practiced and was thought of as mainstream rather than, you know, on the margins of society in India and beyond.
Hmm. Yeah. And you make the argument that there's a convergence of factors that kind of makes this possible. So you say that mobility in a kind of modern contemporary world, religious disillusionment and emerging global consumer markets foster the development of modern yoga in a particular way. Can you talk about what's going on at this moment?
Yeah, so what I'm attempting to do there is to identify how yoga came to establish continuity with consumer culture. Because I'm ultimately arguing that it was only through yoga entrepreneurs in the late 20th century developing that continuity with consumer culture that yoga was able to undergo popularization around the world, in India, in the US, in Western Europe, and eventually nearly everywhere. I look at the developments that enabled the global popularization of postural yoga, first in the sense of just giving yoga more visibility. And so that included in the late 20th century, the new freedom and physical mobility, as you mentioned, just the ability to travel. Increasingly, yoga gurus were traveling across India, were traveling to the United States, into Western Europe, and disseminating various schools of yoga. And so that gave them, the physical mobility gave them increased visibility. And then there was also widespread disillusionment with established religious institutions. And this was primarily in the 1960s with the British American counterculture. And new gurus, or what have popular or have been referred to in religious studies circles as God men, because they were often thought of as embodiments of God. These gurus broke into the competitive spiritual market with wares that were prescribed as solutions to modern problems and the disillusionment with traditional religions. And so you had this transnational rise in adherence to these guru figures who I in the book call entrepreneurial godmen. And the reason I call them entrepreneurial godmen is because they were doing something very different from what traditional gurus had done, the traditional gurus who had come before them prior to the late 20th century. And that is, they were actively seeking disciples. They were traveling and marketing their religious systems in ways that was not a standard method for traditional gurus, who would rather be associated with a particular ashram or a particular location or region, and disciples were expected to come to them. So in order to learn yoga, you had to find a guru in an ashram and go to that isolated place and study in a one-on-one relationship. These entrepreneurial godmen in the late 20th century were doing just the opposite. They were leaving the ashrams. They were going out and seeking students and actively marketing and tweaking their systems in order to speak to large target audiences. Finally, I would just add as a kind of as a general broad pattern that modern postural yoga in particular, which is the system of yoga that has undergone popularization to the greatest degree, the system of yoga focused on physical fitness through rigorous postures and breathing exercises that through which the breath is synchronized with physical movement. That particular school of yoga increasingly intersected with the emergent global consumer culture through these efforts of gurus who sought to align the aims of modern postural yoga with popular demands and desires, such as increased physical fitness according to modern conceptions of health and well-being.
Now, these kind of practices get played out more in the following chapters, where you focus on issues of branding a particular style or persona in relation to a consumer audience. So before you kind of talk about the particular examples you have, you have a little bit in the book about kind of the relationship between consumption, identity, and yoga's various fields of meanings in general. Can you talk a little bit about how yoga branding can signify meaning for an audience?
Yeah, sure. So these yoga entrepreneurs ended up branding their yoga systems. And what I really mean by that is that they came to link their particular yoga systems to popular consumer desires through the use of a particular name or term or symbol that signaled their particular, something particular about their yoga system. And we tend then, because we see these processes alive in the contemporary yoga industry, processes like brand image management, we tend to assume that we can reduce yoga to its commodities. But in fact, I argue that although yoga certainly is, in its popularized varieties, is certainly a product of consumer culture and entails countless varieties and is, in fact, in the United States alone, a multi-billion dollar industry, nonetheless, many yoga practitioners claim that yoga plays a certain role in their life that that I think testifies to my argument that we can't reduce yoga to its commodities. So in other words, yoga in its popularized forms is a product of consumer culture. It does intersect with global market capitalism and its various commodities, but it can't be reduced to those commodities because it is instead something that for many, not all yoga practitioners, is transformative. They testify to it being extraordinarily powerful in their lives. They describe it as spiritual. They describe it as a, maybe they probably wouldn't use the word ritual, but they do talk about yoga as a practice that is set apart from their ordinary day-to-day regimen that has a special place where they transform as individuals. And I think these kinds of claims on the part of yoga insiders should be taken seriously from religious studies scholars. And so if we really start honing in on these dimensions of modern postural yoga, we can find, you know, I think it's inevitable that we will conclude that yoga, even in its popularized varieties, even immersed in countless commodities, is or can serve as a body of religious practice.
Now, this you talk about this in a few kind of important case studies, I guess you could call them, that each kind of have their own unique identity and their own unique branding of its own. So the first one you talk about is this figure, BKS Iyengar.
Iyengar, yeah.
Iyengar. Could you tell us about who this person was? How did he frame his system and what made his yogic system stand out?
Yeah, sure. So Iyengar, he studied with Krishnamacharya in India, in Mysore, in the 1930s. And he is a particularly interesting case. He actually was, Krishnamacharya is, and I don't, these are, this isn't a history that I trace in my book, but I draw from rather Mark Singleton's Yoga Body on the figure of Krishnamacharya. But Krishnamacharya, in short, was a, was one among the first to teach yoga as a physical discipline that intersected with physical fitness. And it was many of his disciples who first went out and started teaching what we today call modern postural yoga. And so Iyengar was the brother-in-law of Krishnamacharya. And Iyengar had suffered many illnesses as a young boy and was really sickly and weak. And he went to Krishnamacharya and with the hope that his brother-in-law could help him strengthen his body and his physical health. And Krishnamacharya had no hope for him. He kind of ignored him, really. And he, you know, allowed him to be there at the yoga school, but he gave him very little attention. Nevertheless, Iyengar practiced his guru's teachings, and he became extremely physically fit, and his life was transformed through modern postural yoga. And so he went on, he moved to Pune first to teach yoga himself. And luckily, he attracted a few disciples who were very wealthy and very impressed with his yoga techniques, which he transformed from the techniques he had inherited from his teacher, Krishnamacharya. So he introduced, for example, the uses of various tools for adjusting the body, ropes, and what are called yoga bricks that are used to position the body in the correct yoga posture and hold it in that posture. So his wealthy disciples in Pune decided, you know, we've got to spread these teachings. We can't allow them to die with our guru. So they paid for him to go to originally London and teach it to students there. And eventually Iyengar traveled to the United States. In both the UK and in the US, he attracted many, many, many more students with his particular brand of yoga, which came to be known as Iyengar yoga. And they went on to teach students So Iyengar was one of the first entrepreneurial gurus who taught modern postural yoga and did so successfully. And what I mean by successfully is I mean he attracted very large audiences and ended up producing one of the most widely consumed yoga schools to this day. A major part of this process was his publication in 1966 of Light on Yoga. And this was a book that is really significant to the history of the popularization of yoga, because Light on Yoga, for the first time, was a book that anyone could pick up and read and learn to do yoga on their own. They didn't have to, you know, not only did they not have to go to India and find a guru in an ashram, they didn't even have to leave their homes. They could simply open up Light on Yoga and read Iyengar's very detailed descriptions of the yoga postures and do it themselves. And a major part of what enabled yoga to undergo popularization was the decision on the part of these gurus to adopt the preference-based language of consumer culture. So these gurus started to advocate for a system of yoga that was meant to fit the individual preferences of consumers. So you could pick up Light on Yoga, for example, and pick and choose among the postures based on your personal needs and preferences.
Now, you also focus on another figure, Muktananda, who developed his own Siddha Yoga system, which you classify as modern soteriological yoga. Could you talk a little bit about who Muktananda was and how his system is differing in both its branding, but also its kind of positioning of its own background?
Yeah, sure. So what I wanted to do in the book was contrast modern postural yoga to other forms of yoga that did not undergo popularization, but nonetheless had high visibility both within India and beyond in the late 20th century. And so one of those schools of yoga is Muktananda's Siddha Yoga. And Muktananda came from a more tantric tradition and was interested in advocating for a school of yoga that emphasized the central role of Kundalini awakening in yoga. So the Kundalini, and this is drawn from that Hatha Yoga tradition I was talking about earlier. The Kundalini is the subtle energy that resides within the body. And within most of us is believed to lie dormant, asleep. And through yoga, we seek to awaken her, to awaken Kundalini, and therefore undergo physical and spiritual transformations through her awakening. And so this was really the concern of Muktananda. And for him, the guru played an absolutely central and authoritative role, because it was through the guru that you had the original awakening of Kundalini. And so disciples were dependent on some kind of access to the guru. It didn't have to be a relationship that was developed over many years in the isolated context of an ashram. Muktananda instead, like other entrepreneurial gurus, traveled. He even left India and came to the United States and actively sought disciples. Disciples didn't have the kind of traditional access to him that they might have to traditional gurus. But nonetheless, it was expected that through your relationship with him, even if brief, you would undergo this initial Kundalini awakening. And again, even if you didn't maintain access to Muktananda because he was traveling from place to place and he developed such a large following that it was impossible for all of his disciples to have a close relationship with him, nonetheless, guru devotion was very important. And so these kinds of dimensions of modern soteriological yoga set it apart as distinct from modern postural yoga. There was far less of an emphasis on an individualized preference-based approach to religion and lifestyle in the modern soteriological traditions, such as Siddha Yoga, as there was in the modern postural yoga traditions, such as Iyengar Yoga. So whereas Iyengar Yoga could easily be combined with a Christian theism or Hindu devotionalism, Siddha Yoga and other examples of modern soteriological yoga couldn't so easily be combined with other worldviews and practices because it was linked to a particular soteriology or path to salvation and devotional tradition focused on the guru and a metaphysical tradition that was based primarily on this Hatha yogic conception of the subtle body.
To wrap up this chapter, you kind of further your explanatory model of this idea of selection, introduction, elaboration, and then fortification through a second generation yoga entrepreneur named John Friend, who's a really interesting character. So what's going on in the second generation and how does it help us think about the development of modern postural yoga?
Yeah, so the second generation modern postural yoga advocates further distance themselves from a particular guru lineage. While it's absolutely important for their own narrative that they still link their school of yoga to having, ancient Indian origins, and they even establish their own authority by claiming to have studied with famous Indian gurus. John Friend, for example, studied with both Swami Muktananda and BKS Iyengar. They provide schools of modern yoga that are further distanced from any conception of guru devotion, and are, you know, further marketed in ways that are, that appeal to an individualized preference-based approach to consumer goods. And so John Friend, for example, he appropriates from the Yoga Sutras a number of components of yoga, but gives them a very contemporary spin that emphasizes, for example, or emphasized, I should say, because I'm talking in the book about his school of Anusara yoga, which, because of a number of scandals, eventually, very recently, became delinked from John Friend. But when he constructed Anusara yoga, he appropriated from this ancient tradition in order to claim ancient origins. But he gave it this very modern spin, which emphasized things like friendliness, happiness, joy, in these other modern conceptions of well-being. And so you could go to his Anusara Yoga website and explore, how he described the goals of yoga. And it would be something very unfamiliar to anyone in the yoga world prior to the late 20th century.
Now, another aspect of the book that you focus on towards the end are kind of the politics of yoga and issues of definitional boundaries. And you open up this section with a really interesting case on the regulation of yoga in Texas. Can you tell us about this example and then what it helps us think about in this idea of classification of yoga?
Yeah, sure. So I talk about a couple of different attempts by different governments to regulate yoga, and they do so, to varying degrees. In the Texas case, they were trying to establish, they were trying to categorize yoga teacher training in a way that would require teacher training programs to pay fees to the government. And this was strongly opposed by many yoga insiders because yoga was thought of as something that couldn't be reduced to a trade skill. And so they wanted it to be exempt from certain taxes that would be placed on teacher training programs. Now, I thought of this particular dimension of the politics of yoga as significant to my larger arguments about modern postural yoga and its popularization, because if you look at the rhetoric that was behind many of the attempts to advocate against the regulation of yoga in Texas, you can find, and this was, by the way, just in the last few years. It wasn't very long ago. In 2010, 2011 is when these debates in Texas were going on. And you could find an enormous amount of religious rhetoric behind the arguments opposed to regulating yoga. So even though many yoga insiders didn't necessarily call yoga religious, because religion in the popular imagination is often imagined as something that entails a static belief system. And so you can't simultaneously hold two different belief systems at one time because they would conflict. And so you're either, a Hindu or a Christian. For yoga insiders, yoga doesn't work that way. Yoga doesn't entail a static belief system. And so they avoid the religious category, since it has that connotation in the popular imagination. And many of these yoga advocates instead described yoga as spiritual, as transformative, as something that you know, doesn't give you a dogma, but gives you a practice that certainly affects your relationship to God, or they might describe it as the divine. Many of them, you know, explicitly do use this language of spiritual, not religious, which, you know, according to many religious studies scholars, we tend to not take that distinction too seriously because we tend to think of religion as something that is far more complex than simply a static belief system. The history of religions has shown that, in fact, religion entails a number of dimensions like ritual and a set of goals that reach beyond just a static belief system.
So part of what's going on here in the book is you're talking about how many have criticized yoga as simply a commodity, this modern postural yoga. But then if we consider how these insiders define and create their own boundaries of what yoga is, we can find new understandings. And this is why you call it a body of religious practice. Can you walk us through how those arguments work? Why are people dismissing it as merely a product? And then what do we gain by thinking maybe more fully or deeply with insiders' perspectives on this?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that yoga is a multi-billion-dollar industry in the United States alone. And we see it everywhere from suburban street corner yoga studios to advertisements for the Gap. And so yoga is very much something that in its popular varieties has become steeped in commodities, the yoga mats, the yoga clothing. And so many contemporary scholars of the history of yoga, the sociology of religion, transnational religion, religion in contemporary culture, many of these scholars have chosen to basically ignore yoga because they think of it as something that can be reduced to the mere commodification of what is otherwise an authentic religious tradition in its popularized forms. But what I attempt to do in the book is look at, okay, how are we defining religion? And if we adopt a definition of religion that is actually conducive to the history of religions as we study it in history in religious studies departments. And what I mean by that is a definition that actually allows us to entail what we claim the history of religions entails. And that definition for me includes a number of different dimensions. First of all, a set of behaviors that are set apart or treated as sacred, as other than ordinary or mundane, that are grounded in a shared worldview, but that worldview need not be all-encompassing, that are grounded in a shared set of values or goals concerned with resolving weakness, suffering, or death, and that are reinforced through myth and ritual. So this is the definition of religion or body of religious practice that I adopt in my analysis of yoga. And I argue, you know, if we think of religion through these various lenses, we find that in contemporary popularized varieties, all of these can be present. They're not always present, but they certainly can be. And so many yoga insiders do treat their yoga routines as a ritual set apart from everyday life that is beyond ordinary, that is transformative, and is linked to the worldview that is dominant in consumer culture, and that is that the body is a part of the self. And so through enhancing the body, whether it's through physical fitness, psychological well-being, or beauty, we're becoming better people. And this is linked to the shared set of goals, resolving weakness, suffering, and death. In consumer culture, we valorize youth And yoga, the yoga industry's definitely has definitely appealed to that popular desire to elongate the youthful period of life, and to whatever extent possible reduce weakness and aging. And these are all reinforced through myth, this narrative, or I should say narratives. Again, I talked about some of the patterns of the various narratives being that yoga has these ancient origins in India, can be tied to texts, particularly the Yoga Sutras, that have ancient Indian origins, or to cultural complexes like Vedic culture or the Indus Valley civilization.
Now, for many contemporary Hindus and Christians, an important question arises, and that's if yoga really is religious, what are going to be the consequences of its rapid popularization? And you you kind of discuss this through two similar but different cases that essentialize what yoga is. One, you posit a Christian yoga-phobic position, and then another, a Hindu origins position. Can you talk a little bit about what these two groups are up to and why they define yoga in the ways they do?
Yeah. So some Christians, including really high-profile Christians like Albert Mohler, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and Pat Robertson, television evangelist and founder of the Christian Coalition of America, and even the Roman Catholic Church, have warned about the dangers of yoga, given the perceived incompatibility between what they believe is its Hindu essence and Christianity. And so this is the position I call the Christian yoga-phobic position, which, like I said, takes a variety of forms, because there are various advocates coming from very different Christian traditions. But I use the Christian yoga-phobic position as a way to categorize these Christian warnings against Christians doing yoga. And some of these advocates add that yoga's popularization threatens the Christian essence of American culture. And so Albert Mohler is my key example of that in selling yoga. So there's two things to fear for Mohler. There's the state of your soul, and there's the state of our nation. These are both under attack by the popularization of yoga, according to Mohler. Now, on the other side, there are Hindu protesters, most notably the Hindu American Foundation, who criticize yoga insiders for failing to recognize yoga's so-called Hindu origins and illegitimately co-opting yoga for the sake of profit. So their position I call the Hindu origins position. They're basically claiming that yoga has been illegitimately stolen from the Hindu religion by profit-seeking entrepreneurs, and that the type of yoga that's popularized isn't real, authentic yoga. Rather, it's this corruption of yoga's true, authentic form. So the two positions are strikingly similar, most significantly insofar as they lean on the misconception that yoga is definitively Hindu. This idea is based on revisionist histories that essentialize yoga's identity, ignoring its actual historical and lived heterogeneity. And so, as I mentioned earlier, by the first millennium of the Common Era, yoga was widespread in South Asia, and Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, and many others prescribed yoga systems, which varied dramatically across different traditions. So throughout its pre-modern history, yoga was, as I put it in the book, it was culturally South Asian, but did not belong to any single religious tradition. Likewise, the history of modern postural yoga problematizes the identification of yoga as Hindu. That history, as shown by other scholars on the history of modern yoga, is a history of cultural encounters in the process of constructing something new in response to transnational ideas and movements, so that modern postural yoga has more in common with military calisthenics from the late 20th and early 20th century, modern medicine, and the physical culture of gymnasts and bodybuilders and martial experts than it does with yoga systems that were pre-modern.
Now, there's tons of other stuff in the book we haven't had time to talk about, but I've kept you longer than I probably should have. Before I let you go, though, could you tell us about the types of things you're working on now, future projects, publications?
Sure. Well, let's see. I am focusing now on a few different projects, but the biggest project is one that is looking at yoga among disenfranchised populations. So what I did with Selling Yoga was I looked at the popularization of yoga, and I looked at the most widely consumed yoga varieties, Bikram yoga, Iyengar yoga, for example. And I spoke mostly about the practices of privileged populations when it came to yoga. People who could afford to pay for expensive yoga classes, expensive yoga gear, and so on. My next project aims to look at how modern postural yoga is a system that is increasingly being practiced among low-income communities, high-risk urban youth, and I think in a way most significantly incarcerated populations. In the United States alone, we have 2 million incarcerated people. And the criminal justice system, in combination with social stigma, relegate the incarcerated to the status of second-class citizens and confine them not only in the prison industrial complex, but even if released, to a marginalized subculture where they're denied access to mainstream society and its economy. And so yoga is increasingly being introduced into prison systems as a form of rehabilitation and empowerment for those who are otherwise systematically oppressed. And so I'm interested in looking at how yoga has or has not served as a body of religious practice among these various disenfranchised populations, and how it has or has not served as a method of empowerment and rehabilitation.
Sounds great. Good luck with that.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. And thanks again for talking about your great book.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was my conversation with Andrea Jane about Selling Yoga, From Counterculture to Pop Culture, published with Oxford University Press in 2014. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion.